Is Able, the radio show about possibility, where we look at what a person with disabilities can do rather than what they cannot do. Hello, this is Dr. Steve Nurse, and this is our series on the Vietnam War. Just to give you a little background, our issue here was to really look at personal kinds of effects of the war rather than political. We'll let the politicians talk about that until they're blue in the face, but we really are interested in the individual veterans that served. Country, I just want to start out by saying Country Joe and the Fish wrote a song. This was actually during the 60s. And they sang in their song these words: "I feel like I'm fixing to die a rag. One, two, three. What are we fighting for? I don't give a damn. The next stop is Vietnam." Country Joe may not have given a damn, but that's not the case for the 2,709,918 Americans who served in uniform in Vietnam, or the 58,148 men and women who were killed in Vietnam. And this also doesn't apply to the 75,000 men and women who were severely disabled in the war. Of that number, 23,214 were 100% disabled, 5,283 lost limbs, and 1,081 had multiple amputations. And as you remember, one of our last interviewees, Dennis Larson, talked about working in the hospitals and helping people there. Well, today we're really going to be talking about a different aspect of the war, not necessarily the boots on the ground folks, but those folks that worked on the river. And not like Ike and Tina Turner working on the river, but more working on boats that were built to go up and down the Mekong and all the tributaries. And the first person we're going to interview here is George Nelson. And George, you've lived here on the island, for 150, 200 years, something like that?
Pretty close.
Yeah, okay.
Most all of my 70 plus years.
And you also, someone also said that you probably know a lot of the 12 people on the island who were killed in Vietnam.
Yes, sir. Went to school with most of them.
Uh-huh.
Some were, Terry Hake was the first one. He was a Marine, died while we were seniors. And
yeah.
Then after that, more.
Yeah. And, you know, interesting thing is that if you look at the statistics, in 1960, there were 125 men aged 18 to 24 on the island. In 1970, there were 225. So if you really look at those, and you look at that whole range, 18 to 24, and in the 66 to 68, when things were really building up, there were a lot, there were probably 130, 140 males. And so really, Vashon lost close to 6 to 7% of the men on the island in that range in that war. And I think that's pretty significant. So you worked on a swift boat, correct?
Yes, sir.
Tell me, thank you for calling me sir. I appreciate
that. Well, you're
that,
younger than I am.
Well, yes, that's good. That's good. Very few people say that anymore.
I tried college. It didn't fit me.
Well, I that was about my last resort, so we did that just fine.
Well, you're very important to have then.
It's almost worth the title to be called Dr. Nurse, you know. So
yeah.
I have a relative nurse, too. So tell me about a swift boat, kind of what they were, how they were, how the armaments were on them, and
Okay, it was taken from a design of the offshore ferry boats to the oil rigs in the Gulf. They added a gun tub and top of the pilot house and a few other things, but it generally had 3 M60s, 6 or 8 M16s, a shotgun, 3 or 4 M79s.
And what's did they have like the rocket propelled units or
those? Later, towards the end.
Yeah.
They're called LAWs.
Uh huh.
One time, bend it up and get rid of it.
Uh huh.
We had 250s on top of the pilot house in the gun tub, and one on the stern, which was mounted piggyback on a 81 millimeter mortar. Mm-hmm.
And they were pretty much just, you know, metal, aluminum, or probably not aluminum, but
what's that? The boat?
The boat itself.
Oh yeah, it was aluminum. It has its benefits. Things go through it a lot easier.
Uh-huh.
They don't stop and make a big pile in one spot. They tend. We got shot at more than once and didn't know it till we walked around, saw little holes here and there.
But yeah.
Usually they didn't. They couldn't hit very much.
Uh-huh. And they were using probably pretty small caliber.
Well, they were AK-47s. That's
right.
A NATO 7.62, right. 308 we hunt with and sniper with and all that.
Okay. And let me also take this time to introduce Roy Bumgarner. And he also has lived on the island. Roy, how long have you lived on the island?
Let me think. Probably about 35 years. I moved over here from Tri-Cities when I was...
Oh, okay. Yeah. And I've been here since about 85, so that means I'm kind of when you were in Vietnam, you also worked on the Swift boats, is that correct?
Yeah, I was electrician's mate, and we used to patch them up when these guys would bring them in full of holes and tear the wiring up, burn stuff up. We'd have to fix it.
Stuff that had shorted out because of.
Yeah, I know we had one instance came in when the boats he's talking about, they called us in and they had a wiring problem down in there. I crawled down in there and, you know, it's pretty damn hot over there. And
yes.
So you got oil and grease and everything else, and you climb down in there, and I grabbed a electrical wire. It looked like it was loose, and it turned out to be a snake. So.
Oh, ouch. A poisonous snake?
I hope not. I threw it just as quick as I found out what it was. I didn't check his gender or anything. I just
It don't take you long to look at him. No. I'll tell you.
Yeah,
that.
That's right. Yeah, there are some things that that you learn very quickly. That must be the inks or instincts from the Cro-Magnon error or something.
Right.
You don't pick up a snake and look it in the face. That's for sure. And let me ask both of you this too, George. When you arrived in Vietnam, did you come in on a boat? Did you come in on a plane? How did that? And what?
Fly
did you
and Tigers gave us a great ride from McCord, to Cameron Bay after a stop in Alaska and Japan fuel.
Mm-hmm.
They had the contract stretch date.
Mm-hmm.
It was about, 60 of the sailors and the rest were Army.
Uh-huh.
Pretty tight.
Yeah, I'm thinking that's,
not a lot of good service either.
Really? No, none of the little bottles, the little drink bottles? Or
well,
anything.
They did make the mistake of let us off in Anchorage, and I've been there fishing, so I knew where the medicine cabinet was, so we got all we could get.
Uh-huh.
That's a long ride over there.
It is, that's
14
right.
hours.
And you know, the one thing that people have told me just in, you know, kind of in general, when they landed there, the thing that hit the most was you kind of get off the plane or you get off the boat and it's just the weather just hits you in the face. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't believe what 110 degrees and 110% humidity does to you. Was that hard to acclimate to, or did you?
Not when you're that young, it's not that big of a problem.
Yeah.
No.
I went over there 4 years ago just with some guys, and it hit me real hard. I just, I couldn't, I was having a heck of a time.
Mm-hmm. And when you were over there, did you get on the boats, and what did you do?
The last time I went we had a group that went over, and we hired these guides, and they had little 150 Hondas, and somebody as big as myself on the back of one of those things, the tires just I was afraid that thing was going to blow any time. But we went from where was it? Well, we started out there in Ho Chi Minh City, and then went up the coast, and went all the way up to Hue, and then we crossed over into Cambodia, Laos. I'm sorry, crossed over into Laos, and did a tour of Laos. Saw a lot of holes in the ground where we really bombed the hell out of Laos, and then we went down to Cambodia from there. And back to Vietnam.
But. Yeah, I understand, too. My friend that lives there in Vietnam says that there's still just tons of unexploded shells and mines that they're still, that they're still finding around there. Even in some of the harbors, mines that have been there still in the water or sunk, and every once in a while somebody will bump into them. Doing that kind of thing. So, and did you arrive by airplane too?
Oh, no, I rode my boat all the way. And it was a converted LST. And I made a repair, used the tank decks for repair shops and everything. Mm-hmm. And you've probably seen them in the movies where they run these things up on the beach there and they drive the tanks off from them.
Right.
Well, the bottom was like a bathtub. Around old bathtub, and boy, that sucker rode hard. we were heading for Hawaii, and it took us like 3 days and to go 20 feet. it was just really rough.
Yeah, that's what they say about the Wright brothers when they took that first flight, and went 145 feet and. Mm-hmm. They said, really slowed their time to the coast when they had to stop and push every 145 feet. Yeah. So that's true. George, the one thing, George came over to my house Thursday night, and we sat around and talked about a lot of his experiences there. But you know which one I'd like you to tell about? The Vietnamese... He was Cambodian. That's right, the Cambodian gentleman that you found. Can you tell us that story? I think that's just fascinating.
Well, in first part of May, they came out with a great idea. We're going to go up to Cambodia, and this was during all the Parrot's Beak and a few other areas where they were. Finally let the guys go, and they went in and got all this ammunition and certain people out of. So we went up to Cambodia. We had two false alarms where you get going, and then they won't tell you to stop and turn around. Finally we did. So ahead of us were, I think it was six Vietnamese swift boats had been turned over, and then our six. And, this has got to be all pretty, so we had to be prayed and this and that, because they had pictures from up above us of it.
Was that the Arvin? The
Yeah. Okay. Well, they're Vietnamese Navy. The Arvin would be their army.
Right. Right. Okay.
Generally speaking, the Navy Vietnamese were the better off than the Army. Mm-hmm. It's kind of that way, I think, everywhere. The Army tends to get the people that can't get their way out of going. So anyway, we went up. We were told this is not going to be fun. They gave us some woven robe, and it's layered fiberglass sheets that we cut and lashed onto all the rails. And went up there, but there was nobody really home alive. The river had quite a few that were past tense floating around here and there. And
so just dead?
Pretty dead.
Because they'd been bombed or they'd been...
They'd been killed by the Viet Cong because they were actively procuring bodies, let's say, in the area. The Air Force, I think it was them, maybe some... They were napalming right off the river. And so they were that. We kind of just went here, went there, and finally we found out, kind of get the feeling what's going on. So we'd anchor, swim during the day, and then at night we had to move and patrol. But finally one day we're coming along and come around the corner, and we haven't seen any live people yet. And here comes a guy running down the beach. He's got a chalkboard, a smaller school type chalkboard, carrying type. And we all had a Vietnamese interpreter. So I asked him, what's it say? And he said he didn't know, Nelly. It's in English. So I said, huh? Yeah. So I took the glasses and looked, and it said, as I remember, please help me. There was more to it than that, I think. So the officer who is in charge said, well, let's go in and pick him up. And I said, how many guns you think are pointed at us? So he said, oh, that's a good idea. And I said, well, I kind of like it, but anyway, I asked him, lie day, and he jumped, threw the sign up in the air, jumped in the river. He looked like one of those water spiders. He couldn't swim, but he could stay on top. And finally got out of ways, and I thought, he's going to get tired. We better not lose him. So I asked a kid, his name was Beats. He was tall, slender, and swim good. And he said, sure. He went over and helped him. We got him up and pulled him up in the bow. We had a cargo net for troop work. And I looked at him. He had his swim trunks on. That's about it. But he was cold. So I said, here, wait a minute. And I gave him one of my shirts and that. And he was severely cross-eyed. I said, how could we help you? He said, we'd like to go to Naval Intelligence, because he had a lot of intelligence from this whole local area because he was born and raised there and his family had a rice mill. And they hadn't drafted him yet because of his cross-eyedness, but they were going to because they were getting kind of short of people. So we took him maybe an hour and a half total time. We took him over to a intelligence boat that was up there with Vietnamese and everybody trying to re-country people. And so he was pretty happy. So we went back, and then we had some fuel line problems. So we had to go back and to Chow Duck in that area and tear a fuel tank out and see what was wrong and fix it. So anyway, we went on patrols and finally we went home. And our Swift Boat Sailors.
You mean home to the United States?
Yeah. Home, home. The other one didn't count. Anyway.
Yeah. And then, but the important part is when you ran into him later in the United States.
Yeah, I was saying our association had a website I used to look at to see if I knew anybody, and I knew quite a few, I guess. But one day a Cambodian gentleman's eating lunch with a couple of the main guys, officers in this association in San Diego, and he starts telling him how his life was saved by a swift boat crew. And he wanted to find this crew and thank them for his life. So I sent a few things and a few more, and, you know, finally, a week later, we're talking on the phone, and it had been almost 40 years since I'd seen him, and it was like 39 years, 362 days. I had my arm around him in San Antonio.
I saw the reunion. I saw the picture, yeah.
Yeah. He's pretty excited. He has two birthdays a year now. He worked in naval intelligence for a year. They told him he could come to the United States, and then they tried reneging on it. But a good old enlisted man said, hey, we've all been to intelligence school. How's he going to work in intelligence without the school like we had? So when he hit the ground running in the U.S. of A., he got a citizenship. They corrected his eyesight. He went to college. And for our hour and a half, he taught our kids algebra for almost 30 years. So
wow.
Returning your money.
Yeah. And it also, I think, shows, and I find this even in today, when we do little things, just little kind things, it just is amazing how sometimes that stuff turns around and really helps us. When you came back to the United States, how were you treated?
Well, I came to Vashon. It was, well, the general public, you talked about the males. We were mostly products of World War II. My grandpa was in World War I, people in Korea. So actually then it was more farm country and that, fishermen.
Right.
So we were just treated normal. Oh, I did go to the tavern. They made me show my ID with my neighbor. But other than that, I wouldn't want to come back now.
So you didn't have a big reunion at the Thriftway or anything?
No, parades, no ticker tape, nothing. Maybe tipped a couple once in a while, possibly.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah, I think that was the same thing. You know, what I noticed from Ellensburg, which, you know, when my fellow graduates came back, they were, you know, treated well. And I think it was, pretty much a farm community.
I lived there for 4 or 5 years on and off, and it's the greatest place I've been.
Uh-huh.
The only thing is their little air conditioning system takes a while, and last time I stayed in it, it's not fun.
It's a windy city, that's right. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think that's really interesting. Anything else that kind of comes out in your mind that you'd like to add about your experience there in Vietnam? Were you it sounds like there were parts of it you really enjoyed. I mean, probably with the camaraderie with the people.
Well, one was a good start and a bad finish. We were called, well, there were two, but anyway, the kids ought to know. We had an extended patrol one day, I'll never forget, because I don't think this kid was 18 on an Army tug. And he helped me fuel a boat up, and he was wearing tennis shoes. Well, in the middle of the night, we got a call that there was a barge adrift with a uniform Sierra on it. Tried to get somebody to tell us coordinates. Nobody knew a whole lot except where it started. So we looked at tide charts and that, tried to get Hueys. They were busy. Just the story, I had to carry his body off when the barge had drifted up in a little canal, and they killed him. He was found by a MAC team, a military assistant that lives in villages for helping them. But anyway, that was bad. Another time we got a call to medevac three girls. We did, and
Vietnamese,
whose side they were on, the odds are they were the bad Viet Cong, but who knows for sure. They were young girls. They patched them a little. We had an hour and a half, 2 hours to get down to the hospital. So tried to do what we could on the way. One passed as we were getting her loaded, because once we got to the hospital, it took our counterparts over an hour to have a beat-up old ambulance show up. So they knew more than we did. They were probably Viet Cong, and they weren't really excited. But to us, they were young girls, people. It broke my heart when I looked in a little locket, little box that one had, and all that was in there for worldly possessions was a broken watch. So that's about it. But
yeah,
we tried to do everything.
You know, I think that's, you know, anytime you have conflicts or wars like you did in Vietnam, you know, there are going to be bad experiences. And, you know, some of these people that I've talked to, some of the people that I've interviewed, have said, you know, these are friends that I've made for life. You know, these are friends that have had my, you know, my life in their hands. You know, the guy on the left of me, and the guy on the right of me. And I think that's really important. And I think it's also important to know that the Americans that were in Vietnam did respect life. And when I talked to Bill Maharin, you know, he was with a pacification team that went in, and I remember, you know, saying that he could remember, you know, taking kids that had been either there'd been a bomb raid or something, had been injured, and they had a medical team and a dental team, and he said, just like you, we didn't know if we were patching up Viet Cong, or we didn't know if we were patching up the good guys, but, you know, you treat life with respect. And so I think that's a good way to end this first half of our interview. And we can get a little bit more from Roy. And I've convinced George not to sing the closing here. So thanks very much, and we'll see you in the next episode.
To stream this or any other episode of Is Abled with Dr. Stephen W. Nurse, go to voiceofashon.org and look under the Shows tab.